into order. So is there a motion to move the minutes from March 6th?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes from March 6th.
Okay, Chair Gomez moves the minutes from March 6th. So first on our agenda today, we'll have an overview of the property tax refund provisions in the 2023 bill that we passed last year. And so we're going to have to, yeah. Oh, do we have to? Oh, right. Sorry. We're all over the place today. Thanks, Patrick. Is there any discussion? Okay, hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, the minutes are adopted. Okay, so back to what I was saying. We are going to start with an overview of the property tax provisions in the 2023 tax bill today. So,
Chair Lee and members, for the record, I'm Sean Williams from House Research. We were asked to discuss some of the homeowner and renter property tax provisions that were enacted in last year's tax bill. The first provision that I'm going to discuss pertains to the homestead credit refund. Just as a kind of basic refresher, we've got a handout in your packet that might sort of give you a reminder of how that refund is calculated, but the refund essentially equals the amount by which property taxes exceed a percentage of the claimant's household income. So the percentage ranges from 1% to 2.5%. If a claimant's property taxes exceed 1% to 2.5% of their household income, they're eligible for a refund. The refund is the amount over that threshold, over that 1% or 2.5% threshold. And it's paid. The amount above that threshold is paid partly by the homeowner and partly by the state as a refund. It's subject to certain maximums that are in state law. For 2024 refunds, the income limit for the refund is $135,410 of household income. Last year's tax bill reduced copay percentages, so that percentage of the share between the renter and the state by 3 percentage points. So for 2024 refunds and later, the copay percentages are 12% to 47%. That's down from 15 to 50%. There's also a couple of temporary changes to the property tax refund programs in the 2024 tax bill. There is a one-time flat increase in the homestead credit refund and the renter's credit of 20.572%. So anyone who was eligible for a refund under the old law provisions saw their refund increase by that percentage. The targeting PTR program, and there's a handout in your packets on that program, too, that describes more of the details of how that refund is calculated, if you're curious. But that's the refund that applies to homeowners that experience an increase in their property taxes from year to year. Under the statutory language, to receive a targeting refund, you need to have an increase in property taxes of 12% year over year. Last year's bill, for one time only for refunds payable in 2023, reduced the percentage increase necessary to receive that refund from 12% to 6%. And it also increased the maximum targeting refund from $1,000 to $2,500. The last provision I'm going to discuss is the renter's credit conversion to an income tax refund. We've discussed this once in committee, so I'm going to be a little breezy with it, if that's okay. So as you know, the renter's credit was converted from a standalone refund program to a refundable income tax credit. And also the measure of income used to calculate that credit was changed from household income, which includes many types of non-taxable income, to adjusted gross income with small modifications for dependents and seniors and people with disabilities. That change is effective for tax year 24, so it will first happen next year in calendar year 2025. There's also some funds appropriated for outreach related to that change. I have a slide in here, and I think there's included in your packet some details of how this household income definition is calculated, the different kinds of non-taxable income that are included in household income. The largest category of non-taxable income is Social Security benefits. The last time I checked, it was about 60%. Of the sort of additional cost or the additional income that's included as non-taxable income. And that covers the property tax refund provisions, and my colleague, Mr. Swanson, is going to cover a couple other provisions.
To your overview, Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and members, so in addition to the property tax refund provisions that were in last year's tax bill, there were a few other provisions in the bill that provided property tax relief for homeowners and renters. So you'll see these on slide six of the presentation, but I'll start with the homestead market value exclusion. So the bill increased the valuation thresholds and the maximum exclusion amount for the homestead market value exclusion. there were two changes to the 4D property tax classification. So the first eliminated the tiers for the low-income rental 4D rental classification that had been in statute and set the classification rate for 4D low-income rental property at 0.25%. The bill also established a new property tax classification now called 4D2, and that is for community land trust properties that are used as homesteads. And the classification rate for this new classification is 0.75%. There is a change to the market value exclusion for veterans with a disability, and this provision allowed surviving spouses to apply for the exclusion with any time after the death of the veteran. The previous limit had been the previous limit for the application window had been 2 years. And finally, the senior deferral program was changed in the bill, and the two changes related to that program increased the income limit required under the program from $60,000 up to $96,000, and it also reduced the minimum number of years a homeowner must occupy the property from 15 to 5 in order to participate in the program. Madam Chair, that concludes the overview of the property tax provisions related to homeowners and renters.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Swanson and Mr. Williams. We're going to move next to member discussion. Representative Garofalo.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to resist the urge to haze you in the chair over there. That's okay. So and this question would either be for nonpartisan staff or perhaps it'll be for the chair of the tax committee. So am I to understand right then that the temporary PTR changes, those refunds and those benefits to taxpayers were temporary. Were any of the tax increases the DFL passed temporary or were those permanent? Maybe the chair of the tax committee could tell us.
I think, well, I don't know if research wants to answer this question or.
I'm good. Oh. Well, that's not fun.
Or Chair Gomez?
I mean, Madam Chair, I mean, I'd prefer not to give my friend over there the pleasure of having me respond to his obviously not in good faith question, but
I thought it was a rhetorical question. That's
here's
why
what I will say. I would love to say a couple things, though.
go through the chair.
Of course you will. Okay.
Chair Gomez.
We did a lot of permanent tax decreases, but not probably for the people who my good friend wanted us to. It's true that we didn't do permanent tax decreases, permanent tax cuts for the wealthy, for corporations, for people who have richly benefited in our economy. Instead, we focused our resources during that time on people who need it the most. So what you'll find if you look in our 2023 tax bill is you'll find a real commitment to working families. You'll find a real commitment to children who are living in poverty. You'll find a real commitment to to our tribal communities, a real commitment to our cities and our counties and our local partners who deliver services to people. So, you know, there is absolutely a lot of and permanent tax refunds that go to lower income renters and homestead property taxpayers. So there's a lot of permanent tax cuts in the 2023 bill, and I'm actually really proud of how we targeted them, even if they don't fit the needs of the wealthy and corporations like my friend across the aisle might have wanted them to. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Gomez. Are there any further questions on the topic before us? Oh, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess that just when I had my taxes done a couple weeks ago, there was a concern raised by the accountant about the rental refund, and that sometimes landlords don't get those certificates out in a timely fashion so that people who might be trying to get their taxes done early can use that and then would have to again come back and do an update on their taxes at a later date. Again, this is just a concern he raised with me. I'm raising it here. If there's an issue, way we can tweak that. And I know it's not going into effect right away, but just wanted to raise that because my tax guy raised it with me.
Sure. Mr. Williams, do you want to explain kind of what we did? Yeah.
Chair Lee and Representative Nelson, I think that the rule and statute is that certificates of rent paid need to be provided by January 31st, which is, you know, pretty early in the income tax filing season. I think that, you know, there may be a few people that file income tax returns prior to January 31st. Obviously, that, you know, if someone is late in sending out one of those certificates of rent paid, it might delay sort of a renter from potentially filing and claiming in a timely fashion if, you know, the CRP was 2-3 months late. You know, other than that, I think that there have been some changes at the Department of Revenue kind of administratively in how those CRPs are distributed by landlords. And I think there may be sort of a new electronic filing system that could also potentially help make that, you know, them get out more in a more timely fashion. But I think that there, you know, I can imagine there may be, I can imagine why a tax preparer might be concerned that someone doesn't receive a CRP in a timely fashion to claim the renter's credit.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Yeah, I think in the tax follow-up.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, and what I'm hearing and what I've found, because I'm passing on his concern, but it sounds to me more like a landlord problem, not getting those certificates out in time, more so than a tax problem.
Absolutely. And I was just going to mention, we did have a hearing on this topic in the tax committee where I think the department is rolling out an electronic system that will hopefully address these concerns. So thank you for raising that. Any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Swanson, Mr. Williams.
Okay, so next on our agenda, we're gonna move to consideration of House File 4494. And as Mr. Walgamott is making his way up, the chair is gonna move that House File 4494 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. To your bill, Representative Walgamott. Welcome back.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It is my honor to be here this morning to present to you House File 4494, a bill to allow the City of St. Cloud or its Economic Development Authority to establish redevelopment tax increment financing districts. We are here to present this bill, Madam Chair, because unless you've been living under a block of granite, you've probably heard about our ambitious plans to revitalize downtown St. Cloud with historic public investments in increasing public safety, making downtown more walkable, more safe, more inviting to businesses, more beautiful. We are really have an ambitious agenda to follow in the footsteps of Duluth and Rochester and secure $100 million in capital investment projects from the state. And the goal of that is to spur over $1 billion in private investment. That's why we're bringing this bill before you today, to make multiple sites throughout Stearns County and Benton County more attractive to private developers to come in and make the investments that we need in downtown St. Cloud to revitalize it and make sure that it is a tool of economic growth for decades to come. That's why we're here before you today, Madam Chair, and to shed more insight on why we're bringing this bill forward, on the impact that being able to create these TIF redevelopment districts would have on downtown St. Cloud. I have some testifiers from the City of St. Cloud to give you more information.
Great. Thank you, Representative. So first I have on my list Mayor Dave Kleiss. Please state your name for the record and your title.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dave Kleiss, Mayor of the City of St. Cloud. Appreciate Madam Chair and committee members for the opportunity to be here. As Representative Ogremont mentioned, we have a pretty significant a plan to really I think downtowns around the country and around the world changed, I think, as a result of COVID, and maybe they were heading in that direction. But one of the things that's, for a community like St. Cloud, which is a regional center with a population. The City of St. Cloud is about a little over 70,000, but we have a daytime population of about 180,000. So as a region, pretty significant region growing, the downtowns are important. In fact, I think most studies that we've looked at have shown that, the largest amount of people in the workforce are millennials, and they want to live in urban walkable communities. And, in fact, in studies that I've seen nationally, most of those are higher than 70%. So if that's the largest part of your workforce, and even if the folks that are in the baby boomer generation, which I'm on the tail end, I think that last year, that baby boomer generation, are looking at retiring into places that are urban and walkable. And so if you look at central Minnesota as a whole, we analyzed that region, and we have less than 1% that's walkable urban in central Minnesota. And the area that we can actually build on is our downtown. Downtown that is thriving. It's on the Mississippi River, which we know here in Minnesota is the most important river in the world, and an important river. We're up at the upper area here in Minnesota, and we get a significant amount of tourism, but it's also a superhighway all the way down to the Gulf. And so it's an important asset, and it's important. And almost any downtown, any water is considered gold, or actually if you're looking at economic development, it's considered platinum if you have the river. And we have the river that flows through our community, separating in east and west. So that overall request that we have in bonding, which is not the purview of this committee, but this is a different tool that we can use to help revitalize, and that's tax increment financing. And the TIF that we're looking for really is the flexibility to utilize that, as is outlined in the legislation. Is really to look at we have properties that that wouldn't otherwise qualify as blight that are surface lots. We have a significant amount of surface lots, and those surface lots really you're not taking care of a structure, but that will help us utilize those lots so that we can utilize those to turn them into taxable properties, which will actually help with some of the costs of the infrastructure both in the district and outside. We are a little unique also in the fact that I know we're in three counties, so our city lies in three counties. So also the flexibility in the downtown area is in two counties, but the city itself is in three. But really trying to leverage the flexibility to allow us to utilize the benefit obviously is for us to be able to do things in that district to actually leverage. Our goal is to leverage private investment. The housing that we're looking at doing downtown is going to be private housing. For us to do that, we're going to have to utilize some of those surface lots, and some of those other properties around there will also enhance that ability to, whether it's parking structure, whether it's the infrastructure, for utilize those dollars to be able to do that, to increase that private piece. I'll stop there. I do have here, for if there's any technical questions, my Director of Economic Development for the City of St. Cloud, Kathy Mihelich, who is here to answer any of the questions and probably answer all the questions since she's an expert on these types of things here for us. So, but Madam Chair, that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mayor Kleiss. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify on this bill? Okay. So seeing none, we are going to move to member discussion. Oh, Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just reading through the this document, the development opportunity sites, and reading about the North Downtown Riverfront and the 90-unit public housing building that's currently there. And it talks in here about demolishing and relocating those families. I'm just curious about the plan there. Public housing is precious. It's in short supply. And, you know, we have a housing crisis, especially for low-income people. And, we have a $500 million deferred maintenance issue in our public housing portfolio across the state. And so, I'm just curious in what the idea is there, what the plan is there, and what is going to happen to all of those people, because replacing a public housing building where you have to pay a percentage of your income in rent, which is how those are structured, and putting those people on like a Section 8 voucher potentially, which is usually what happens, it sucks for the families, I guess, is what I'll tell you. And so I'm just want to know more about that part of the plan.
Mayor, okay. Representative, or Mayor Kleiss.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, appreciate the opportunity to answer that. A lot of what we're looking at downtown is part of our overall comprehensive plan. this is one of those catalyst sites. And I agree with you 100%. This is a facility that is public housing, operated through our HRA, federal housing. We've actually been working at the federal level for, it's amazing because it's probably been two or three U.S. Secretaries of Housing to move the facility for a number of years. The facility is built in the 70s. And I actually had a godmother live there in the 80s, and I thought it was substandard then, and I believe it's substandard now. In order to move public housing, as you're well aware of, you have to have either equal or better housing. And in this location, in that building, especially it's a high rise, and most of the folks that are housed in there have disability issues, and it's a large building. But we're actually looking at a different site, not too far from there. In fact, several blocks from my house in my neighborhood, where we could actually expand the capacity. There's a pretty significant waiting list to be in that facility, about 1,600 individuals, and it doesn't house that many. We're looking at not only building a new structure that's in a position, in a place where it has bus access, it has walkable, another walkable area, has an area where you can get to pharmacy, to grocery, on a bus route, but also can increase the capacity. The capacity of that facility is not going to go up anywhere, and the capacity, it's not going to go anywhere. It's pretty solidly structured. It's a structure, but it was built in the 70s, and it is really, in my opinion, not the standard of housing that you would want. That is a catalyst site for redevelopment. Rather than build that there, put it in a place that's better and in a low rise with more ability to expand, but more importantly, to expand the actual housing opportunities for that facility on a different site. That we have to work with the federal government before. In fact, we had both Senators Klobuchar and Senator Smith actually were working on an earmark to do a study, because in order to do that, we'd still need to do the study to make sure that the housing that they could move into would be equal or greater in order to do that, to move any subsidized housing in that area. So that's just the structure that our comp plan would be better used. It's connected to the river, the convention center. It would be better probably connected so that it fits within that entertainment district, but to replace that with additional housing. But we're looking at overall in the downtown increasing 1,000 housing units. That's part of our plan. That's part of the reason we have a bonding request, private investment in housing. So we're looking at in the next 5 years, the goal is to add an additional 1,000 units to downtown. Not take away anything in this case. We have other subsidized units there, but to actually increase the capacity for that facility, not too far, downtown adjacent from where we're talking about, but in a better lower, not high rise, but a better building.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this relocate, I mean, but is it going to be real public housing that you're building at this other site, and is there an actual plan for it? Because our federal government has spent the last 50 years disinvesting from public housing just more broadly, which is why we have that $500 million in deferred maintenance in our public housing portfolio across the state. And I mean, I haven't seen anybody building new public housing. In fact, it's mostly going the other way. So is there an actual plan to build not subsidized housing, not Section 8 eligible housing, but public housing?
Mayor Kleiss.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, yes, it would be required, actually. That's the federal requirement that we're looking at. It's required by federal law to if you're going to reduce or eliminate, you have to put back at the same level or better and the same amount of units. So, yes, it would be public housing, and that's actually what we're looking at. But in order for us to do that, in order for a developer to do that, and we've got a site actually identified already, in order for them to do that, we have to go through the federal process of making sure we have the study, and then have the ability to transfer the funds that are used for that to another site. And a developer can't do that until we have at least something on this site. It's separate from our bonding request. It's separate from our TIF. It's actually something we're working with the U.S. Department of Housing and also with our congressional delegation.
Chair Gomez.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe we can follow up, because just wanting to learn a little bit more about the timeline for that relocation, just because, if you destroy public housing without a seamless place for people to go, they lose their spots, and it's just incredibly disruptive. And so if that's how it's going to go, I'm really curious to learn how you guys have managed to make that happen, because they can't do it in my city. So maybe you can give me some pointers. And then just generally, just since it's our first TIF bill of the day, I want to say my normal thing, which is like when we see TIF proposals, it's because we're asking for exceptions to rules. I think this is like a really, I appreciate this vision, and especially, you know, the commitment to housing, to walkability, to density. I think those are all like important goals for us to have for livability, for climate, for all of the things that all the challenges that are to come in our communities. But we are going to be just looking really carefully at exceptions to the current to the TIF that is allowed by to be used by right for cities that's already in statute. I do just want to mention on this one, which is a little bit different than a lot of the TIF projects that we see, is that there is that you've been working with your county and your school district, and I'm really happy to see that, because I think when we overutilize TIF and when we're asking for exceptions to extend the time, then that's a decision that a city makes, but they don't have to ask their county, they don't have to ask their school board, and all three of those entities would be losing out on that increment that gets diverted, to make these improvements. So just want to compliment you for that. I think that's a really good part of this project. And we're just going to be taking a look at all of the TIF projects and all these exceptions and really, trying to make sure that we're keeping true to sort of the spirit of what these districts are supposed to be used for. But I appreciate you being here. Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do want to state that the beginning part of this committee was very enjoyable, and we had an improvement. But no, it's good. It's good to see you at the gavel again. To Chair Gomez, I also find problematic the idea that you don't first build and then move the people into it before you tear down, especially if you're not remodeling or reconstructing. Because, this is basically saying, what do you do first? And to me, I think it's problematic to those families by not planning the appropriate order of execution. I would like a new practice on these TIFs and these type of bills is if we can have staff tell us, are there any new precedents being set, or are these just a very consistent over the years, this is a very common thing of where someone comes and does that? Because to me, there's a difference between new precedents and very common exceptions, because if it becomes very common, we may actually be able to some of them make statutorily allowable options. I'm not saying for all of them, because the discussion here, I think we give input that maybe improves your projects. But it looks as if the tax chair likes the idea of having all the members understand what possible new precedents are. The statement about copying two cities of the first class, when you're a city of the first class, there are special constraints and also special allowances, because you're over 100,000, and there's a reason why we designate that as a state. And just because two cities of the first class are doing similar projects, it might be a new precedent for a city not of the first class to do some of these things. And so when an author is looking at it, might be good to look and see, maybe there are things that cities of the first class do or allowed to do that we now need to allow cities that are above 50,000 some leeway in doing. But I'm very cautious about new precedents, because we have to be careful that we don't cause problems. But I'm going to sit back and look, for the rest of the testifying.
Anyone else? Last word.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, once again for the opportunity to come before you and present House File 4494. In closing, I really want to thank and give credit to Mayor Dave Kleiss for his bold, ambitious vision of revitalizing downtown St. Cloud and bringing us through the dark days of the pandemic into economic revitalization that is going to benefit Central Minnesota for generations to come and be an economic powerhouse for the state of Minnesota for generations to come. I'm so honored to be part of this plan, and I ask for your support in empowering us with another tool to have public-private partnerships that will spur economic development. I ask for your support for House File 4494.
Rep. Lee renews her motion that House File 4494 be laid over for possible inclusion to Property Tax Division report. The bill is laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, we have House File 4771. The chair moves that House File 4771 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. And with us, we have Representative Akam to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate being here this morning to present House File 4771. which is adding special terms to a renewal and renovation TIF district that was created in the city of Minnetonka in 2021. The district was created with the goals of promoting redevelopments and the future transit line, around the future transit line, addressing several major road circulation and traffic light improvements in the area pursuant to alternative urban area review the city completed in order to accommodate redevelopment and developing new housing along the transit route at varying income levels. And just to point out, this is a 16-year district, and to date, 1,652 units have already been constructed in the area, and approximately 40% of the units have affordability at varying levels. Many of the improvements that were identified in the alternative urban area review are not able to move forward due to timing issues with the Minnesota Department of Transportation and their planned improvements that coincide with the city's improvements. This jeopardizes the city's funding and by the required five-year date that would be ending in June 16th of 2026. Therefore, this bill extends the five-year rule to 10 years to allow for coordination with MnDOT. It excludes the district from the six-year rule because the improvements meet the 4J requirements to eliminate blight, and this bill would not extend the overall term of the district. It would remain at 16 years. With me today is Julie Wishnack, our Community Development Director with the City of Minnetonka, and she can really talk about the details of which I am just reading.
Thank you. Welcome. Please state your name for the record. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. My name is, again, Julie Wishnack. I am the Community Development Director for the City of Minnetonka. I have been with the city for 18 years and have enjoyed working on very complex projects like what you see in Opus. Opus, if you're not familiar, is at the intersection of 169 and 62 Crosstown. It has been kind of a renaissance of redevelopment in recent years as the transit improvements have been happening. Development interest and the reuse of previous office spaces has been prolific. Our impression of all of the housing that has been coming to the city has been quite positive and has been a really good move for the city in terms of creating more affordable units. It has been a challenge to create affordability in all of these projects, as everybody here knows. But what I'm really most proud of is that percentage, the almost 40% in the last few years is considered affordable. But because of the development and the changing dynamics of the kind of development that is occurring in Opus, we're required, obviously, to support that with public improvements, new road improvements, street lights, stop signs, et cetera. And so all of those improvements require coordination with the development, coordination with MnDOT, coordination with the transit improvements, and all of that timing. As you know, there was a pandemic since we had adopted this TIF district. And so all of that kind of flowed into why we need a little bit of an extension. Again, the district itself is not extending. It's just that five-year rule that we're asking for. With that, Chair, I'll leave my comments short so that you have time to ask questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone in the audience want to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, member discussion. Anyone? Anyone? Oh. Well, you didn't have to.
I didn't have to, but Mr. Chair, this this development was part of my district prior to redistricting, and so I'm very familiar with the area. And I just want to say this is a really good project, and it's just a timing issue. We run into this in Bloomington all the time. Lay out a plan, and then COVID happens, and your timing gets thrown into a cocked hat, and it's nothing you can do about it. So this is a good project.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question about timing and such. It looks like the original TIF was established only 3 years ago in 2021, and now you're asking for some exemptions and special rules. Has anything changed in these 3 years to require differences with MnDOT to be worked out differently, or why in the short span of time are you asking for some of these special rules for the project?
Ms. Whitman.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. I think the biggest change is that the timing of development and the projects that are required to support that development is really what kind of impacts the time frame in which we have to build the required improvements. And so not only are you thinking about development timing, and typically it's an 18-month period in which an apartment building is built, but then you have to think about MnDOT and the lead time and the bridge work that needs to be happening on Shady Oak Road specifically, as that project takes a lot of coordination and years of coordination. So we know that coordination will take at least 3 years. The development timing kind of ebbs and flows depending on the market. So I think all of those factors are impacting that short window of time that we have.
Mr. Anderson. Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at this, I don't see any new precedents. I think this is something that we see somewhat regularly, this type of extension. And I understand a lot of things happened during COVID that caused delays and reconsiderations. So I don't have any other questions other than to make that statement. But, again, whenever we have, this type of a thing, if we can look at what are new precedents, because that's a less than trivial thing. Thank you.
Closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Really appreciate the opportunity, and this is a good project. Minnetonka is doing good work, especially focusing on achieving affordable housing goals. So thank you for your consideration, and I hope that you can consider including it in the final bill. Thank you.
Chair renews his motion that House File 4771 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. The bill is laid over. Thank you. All right. Next up, we have House File 4301, Chair Gomez. Chair Gomez moves that House File 4301 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. I see a whole lot of smiles going on. There is an A1 amendment. Chair Gomez, would you also like to move your A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape you like it?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Okay. She moves the A1. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Chair Gomez, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So happy to have 4301 in front of the committee today, which is basically an exemption for the Red Lake Nation Tribal College for property taxes on their college that they're building in the city of Minneapolis. And it's sort of this is really about the timing that a tax exempt entity acquires a parcel and the schedule for levying those property taxes. There's basically like a kind of disconnect there, and you know, Red Lake Nation Tribal College, even though they're tax exempt, would be would have to pay some property taxes for part of the year after they acquired the property if we don't take this action today. And so I'll just leave it at that and then turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are we waiting for a presentation here?
I think so.
Okay. This is where I call my wife and ask her to help me. But...
And does she?
Get a teenager.
Or get a teenager, that's right.
Turn it off and turn it on is what Representative Holland says.
That's actually what every IT person says first.
Yeah, that's what they'll say if we call IT.
To reset.
Shots are unnecessary to IT.
Is it? How are you not leaping your feet to come to our rescue here?
You didn't buy the service contract. Madam Chair, is your testifier going to walk through the presentation?
Yeah, I could just lead you through.
We all have it in our
packet. Yeah, why don't we start, and then if they can get that would be wonderful. If not, we will continue to move forward. So I'm Chief Dan King, President of Red Lake Nation College. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Chief Dan King, President of Red Lake Nation College. And I want to thank the chair, vice chair, and all the committee members for hearing us today. And I just have for you today for consideration House File 4301. And I'll just take you through that real quick. First, I wanted to give you just a quick update on our Red Lake Nation College in Minneapolis. While many two-year state colleges and universities are decreasing enrollment of 10 to 25% or more, our enrollment has a record enrollment right now. We grew 25% in 2022, 43% in 23, and we're looking at 50% plus enrollment, mainly due to our high flex class model of in-person or online and the new Minneapolis site, which is opening June 6th, thanks to the state legislature and the $3 million bonding bill that went through last year. And we're moving in on May 1st, and it was on schedule, under budget. $16 million project, and all of you are invited to that grand opening on June 6th in downtown Minneapolis. And here's our issue is the city county assessed us $156,000 in property taxes, even though we're tax exempt in three different ways. First, we're a federally recognized Indian tribe, a sovereign nation. So just like England or France, we should not be taxed. Number two, we're an IRS-approved 501c3 college since 2010. And number three, we're a nonprofit single-owner entity, LLC. Under Minnesota law, we're not supposed to be taxed. So if we were allowed to be taxed, we would be the only tribal government to be taxed in Minnesota. We would be the only college to be taxed in Minnesota. And we would be the only tax-exempt LLC to be taxed in Minnesota. So it's pretty clear we shouldn't be taxed. But this financial injustice could easily be fixed, and it really is important because our project is transformational with job training and education for the Native community, which greatly needs it. And this process really, the $3 million bonding, we can't even access it until we take care of this issue. So there is some urgency on this, and we might not even be able to use the $3 million in bonding to pay for these taxes. So it's preventing us from getting the $3 million that was approved. And the city did deny our abatement request, even though they have the authority to grant it, because they're saying that the state law of the date of when the purchase, we're taking the tax status of the previous owner. So it's basically a state law that they really can't do anything about. So they're saying the only thing that we could do, the potential solution, is to do what we're requesting, is special legislation to abate all taxes, fees, and penalties under HF 4301, and there's a Senate file 4380. According to the city, this has been done in the past, and the city is supportive of us, And we have a support letter from the county, the Hennepin County Board. So they are also very supportive. They want us to be there. They're excited about us. And so everybody's saying, yes, they should be tax exempt, and they are supportive. We have the support letter in your packet. So that's our consideration.
Chair Gomez.
Oh, thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I know that we don't have a revenue estimate, I don't think. At least there's not one in my packet. Is there one in yours?
Yeah.
Oh, there is?
Yeah, it's okay. $156,000.
Well, but that's the cost to you guys, but I believe the cost, I don't have the cost to the state is $10,000, I believe. Oh, there it is. Oh, okay, yeah. Oh, sorry. So I didn't have the revenue estimate in my packet, sorry. So there is a cost, one-time cost to the state of $122,000. Thank you.
See, Chair Gomez, you know how blessed you are. You got Chair Gomez doing tax breaks.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just not normal. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, no, I understand your presentation, and I understand the idea, and it's been stated that this is not a new precedent. What I'm confused about is if they should not be collecting the tax, then why is the state paying it?
Chair Gomez, let me go to staff.
Maybe.
Let's go to
maybe Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Swanson seems like he's the smart guy here.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kwan, so when a property is purchased, even if it's going to be used for it, even if it's going to be tax exempt after the purchase, it can still remain taxable both in the year that it's purchased and in the following taxes payable year if it was purchased after July 1. So a tax exempt property that's purchased after July 1 will still be taxable in the following calendar year.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I understand that. My statement wasn't that it pertained to why is the state of Minnesota paying the tax, which apparently every entity believes should be, except for a technicality, not have been assessed at all. So the bill should say we're fixing this technicality because there should have never been a tax. So therefore, the state should not be paying a tax that the bill is taking care of, so that it legally wouldn't be needing to be paid. To me, it's a simple question. Should we not? Should it be tax exempt? Yes. So then why is the state paying it if they shouldn't have been assessed to begin with? And we're taking care of the technicality because of this special case, which is not a precedent because it's been done before. So I can support this bill if the state's not paying the tax.
I would like Department of Revenue, if they could come down and clarify.
Mr. Chair, could I add a comment?
Go ahead.
The state of Washington actually has that actually is a great question. The state of Washington has a law that addresses this issue. And what they do is upon immediate purchase, whether it's a tribe, a state, or a federal government entity, if they buy a property, it immediately becomes tax exempt. And that would avoid that particular issue. And we have a copy of that state law. And we just felt that was maybe asking a little too much, but it really does address the problem of preventing this from happening in the future.
Ms. Barris, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, I think that the issue here is that because local governments are doing their budgets, they need to know a time frame for when, you know, that property is going to be exempt or not exempt. And so after that July 1st date, it becomes difficult for them to do their budgeting if all of a sudden a property becomes exempt. So because that tax is still due at that time, the state's making that payment.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you. I thought in the testimony the city was aware of this that was in the discussion, and it sounded as if they they felt that, no, it shouldn't be taxed, but they didn't do a exception. So frankly, the city should not have planned on having the money, collecting the money to begin with. And frankly, I would hope that the author would have this bill improved so that we don't have to go through this churn again, that it is clarified. And that's part of the reason why I brought up the question. I'm glad that the head of Red Lake is aware of that, and maybe we can get this taken care of before it hits the floor and avoid this ever in the future. Thank you.
Stephen Huser, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Huser, City of Minneapolis Government Relations Representative. I'll apologize in advance. This isn't my normal area of expertise, but I'll do my best to answer. I think the Department of Revenue kind of explained the technical realities that we're faced with. I will say, though, as was stated before, the city is supportive of this legislation, and I think for today what I'll say is we will continue to work with the author. We will continue to work with Red Lake Nation to improve the bill and make the necessary changes to make sure that this can be done expeditiously so that they can continue the good work that they want to do within the city of Minneapolis.
Thank you. You're good? Anyone else? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of carrying along that same line, the bill summary opening line says provides a property tax exemption for taxes paid in 22 and then portion in 21. Well, the state is actually going to pay the tax, so it seems to me like a misnomer to say we're providing an exemption because the tax is going to be paid, evidently, by the state. And my other point is, being the sale took place after July 1st, I don't know when it was, I guess August and September, could there have been something in the purchase agreement specifying that the seller would pay the taxes for the rest of that year? I think that's customary when it goes past that July 1st date for the taxes that were payable for the rest of 2021. Was that at all part of the discussions when this purchase was made?
Chair Gomez.
Thank you. Just to clarify, if you look at the second line of the summary, so there's kind of two parts to it. There's first the abatement, and then there's also just the part where the state pays a refund to the property owner for the amount attributable to the exemption. So that is just a part of the bill. But I'll go to President King.
Yeah, when our lawyer made the reviewed the final, he said, well, we're tax exempt, so we wouldn't pay it. So that was removed, I guess.
Representative Anderson.
No further comments.
Anyone else? Closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is laid over, so we'll continue to work on it. I think I'm going to have a conversation with Lead Quam and make sure that that all of his questions are answered and any concerns he has are addressed. I'll just say, as a Minneapolis resident who. A lot of the Red Lake tribal members live in our communities in the city, and we're just really thankful for the Red Lake Nation bringing this amenity to Minneapolis, to serve not only their tribal members who are also, our constituents in Minneapolis, but also, the dozens of tribal nation members who are in Minneapolis and others. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Gomez renews her motion that House File 4301 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. The bill is laid over. Okay, next up we have House File 3460. Representative Coulter moves that House File 3460 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. To your bill. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. So House File 3460 really builds off of work, some of which we even discussed today, that we sort of began last year, and work I think that really is ongoing. That would include the bill that I was the author of that converted our renter's credit into an income tax credit. I know Representative Anderson has a bill that I'm a co-author of that would have, that also would have included the property tax refunds. And Representative Norris even has a bill this year to convert the targeting property tax refund to an income tax credit. And to me, what that shows is, I think, a bipartisan desire to get our property tax refund dollars back into Minnesotans' pockets faster and more efficiently. We are in polite company, so I won't use the term that I normally use to describe our property tax system, but let's just say it starts with B and rhymes with pulpit. And this is one of the reasons why. It's just an unwieldy system that a lot of folks don't participate in, frankly, because they don't often know that they need to fill out a separate form to get their property tax refunds. And so I think having sort of starting from that point, and there are a number of reasons why that I'm working on, having started from that point and having the conversations that I've had with a lot of folks, it's clear to me that there needs to be more sort of examination of the way our property tax refunds are structured, how they interact with local governments and the budget and levying process that we know can be complicated and is set on a very specific timeline. And so that is where this bill came from. And what this bill does is that it requires the Department of Revenue to really study the issue more thoroughly, to make recommendations to the legislature on how to simplify the process, improve participation, ultimately, I think, with the goal of achieving more automatic and universal participation in our property tax refunds. In essence, how can we do it better and make sure that folks get the money that they should be entitled to? And so I think this would just ensure that everybody involved with the process has better information, more information to really guide us in our decisions moving forward. So that is the bill, in short.
Okay. Nobody has signed up to testify. Anyone in the audience want to speak for or against the bill? Don't everybody come down at once. Okay. Member discussion. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to thank you, Representative Coulter, for bringing this forward. I was just whispering to Chair Gomez that I did not apply for my property tax refund for several years after first owning my house because I didn't realize that it was a separate process. And so, I think a lot of folks would appreciate it being a simpler process and understanding what they need to do. So thank you.
Thank you. Closing comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hollins. My wife actually made a very similar comment to me when I applied for our property tax refund this past year. So, I will just say, the bill itself calls out potential options. If members have other ideas about sort of options that they would like to see explored, I would certainly welcome those. The property tax refund is a large number, and I think it's important that given that size, we really understand sort of the variables that are involved with what it would mean to make it more automatic and more available to folks. So that is the bill. Thank you, members.
All right. With that, Representative Coulter renews his motion that House File 3460 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. The bill is laid over. That concludes today's agenda. We will be reconvening March 20th at 10:30 with the agenda to follow. Anything else? We are adjourned.